Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled, A Conversation with FCC Commissioner Michael O'Reilly. Telephone Consumer Protection Act landscape after Barr v. American Association of Political Consultants. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Michael O'Reilly, a commissioner at the Federal Communications Commission, Scott Delacorte, a partner at Wiley Ryan, who has a broad range of experience in transactions, FTC, FCC investigations and enforcement, and wireless telecom and data privacy and security. He's also the chair of Wiley's FTC practice group. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Scott, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much. On May 6th, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Barr versus American Association of Political Consultants, which offered a rare look into the court's views of the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, a controversial robocall statute. And we're very happy today to have Commissioner O'Reilly to discuss the case with us. He's long been an influential voice on TCPA issues. Just to set the case up, at issue is a 2015 amendment to the TCPA that exempts federal debt collection calls from the TCPA's restriction on placing automated calls to wireless phones without consent. The American Association of Political Consultants, which has an interest in political calling, took the position that, as amended, the TCPA makes content-based distinctions as to permitted speech, and as a result should be subject to strict scrutiny under the First Amendment. They argued further that the speech restrictions couldn't survive a strict scrutiny review and urged the court to strike down not just the amendment that was imposed in 2015, but the statute itself. The government, for its part, took the position that the 2015 amendment regulates economic activity, not speech, and should be reviewed under a reasonableness standard. Under this more relaxed standard, they argued the 2015 amendment should be upheld. If, however, the court were to find that the amendment unconstitutional, the government argued that the remedy would be to sever the amendment and preserve the statute intact. Commissioner O'Reilly, did you have a chance to follow the oral argument? They're a little more accessible these days now that they're streaming them online. And any impressions you would like to share?
Well, Scott, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. It's a really important topic. I did get a chance to listen to the case, hear the different arguments from the presenters and from the judges themselves. It was really interesting dialogue between the two. But they, as they say, this is the case isn't exactly on point in terms of TCPA direct attack or direct challenge. It's a portion of it, as you did a very good job outlining the situation. So a very unique dialogue occurred, I think, and you saw early on, and I look at it, I have to preface this and say, no one can predict where the Supreme Court's going to go with something. I have a bad track record after some healthcare issues in the past of guessing where I thought the court might go. So my guess on where they ultimately may land is probably not worth all that much. But when I heard the court say, it was certainly a general agreement from a number of justices that the First Amendment challenge from the modification just made by the Congress not 20 years ago was certainly viable. And the biggest piece that did more time, or at least the more energy, seemed to be on the severability question.
I would agree with that. And let's talk a little bit about that. If the court were to find that the consent exception for calls to collect government debt violated the First Amendment, then of course they'd have to go to remedies. And as you point out, the government urged a narrow approach of severing the amendment, creating the exception and upholding the statute. But the political consultants urged something far more reaching, overturning the entire statute, because the automatic telephone dialing system restriction, they argued, and the accompanying consent requirements themselves are overbroad and unjustified restriction on speech. From an FCC perspective, what would be the impact of the statute itself being overturned?
Well, look, at in fairness, and I certainly took the court's different questioning, you know, to heart, and was intriguing in terms of where they may or may not land on the severability question. But if they were to go to the broadest sense and invalidate the statute on the constitutionality, I think that, you know, what, for our purposes of the commission, I'm not sure that would change all that much, because we already have the definition of ATSC already being challenged. It's already a mess on what qualifies and doesn't qualify. And that's something that's been some of our fault for lack of clarity. It's an overreach from past commissions and what they've done. So I'm not sure the ramifications are that significant. Now, what if it may mean for purposes of some of the work that we've done on the illegal robocalls, were clearly outside the bounds of some of the statute, or out the violations are clearly clear, you know, then I think you get a situation where people have articulated where it would provide the energy to Congress to come in and provide a much more clear statute. So that to me is actually could benefit everybody in the process, because what we're living under now is a complete mess.
So you've been very active on TCPA issues, and the FCC's work has been on most recently on blocking the origination of illegal robocalls. But the court was more interested in the First Amendment implications of the statute, this idea that speech involving the collection of government debt would be treated more favorably than other speech for TCPA purposes. Do you have any views on the impact of the TCPA as a limitation on speech, particularly on political speech and commercial speech?
Look, and I may be, you know, and I've talked about this in a number of speeches and over the years, I may be more sympathetic to the protections for commercial speech and protected speech than some others that are out there. I know when we did the Do Not Call list, there were challenges that eventually didn't make their way in, but I was more sympathetic to the First Amendment challenges that were made at the time, because, you know, commercial speech is protected. People don't seem to like that fact, but it is. The protections may not be to the fullest degree that are provided to individuals, but they are provided and have court precedent for those purposes. So I'm probably more sympathetic than some, and we'll just have to see where that goes as the court plays this out, because it's really fundamental. You're absolutely right where they, you know, it's much more about the First Amendment piece, because we've lived under the statute since 92, really, in the implementation years, and people seem to find it a popular statute. Nobody likes illegal robocalls, but that's not the issue at hand. The question is, you know, you highlighted a number of the different technologies that we've worked through over the years, and tried to deal with those issues. And I think that just recently, I've been more, you know, more favorable towards what we've tried to get to, is the illegal robocalls happening overseas, because that's been a big portion of calls. They are coming into the United States in different forms. Trying to get to those and really tackling those are, to me, the, you know, a primary function of the regulator. What we found in our past efforts is we've been splitting hairs with legitimate companies and trying to and really been problematic for terms of their operations and using technology for good purposes.
Yeah, and that work has been really helpful in bringing the numbers down on the total call volumes, although I gather it still continues to be right up there in terms of consumer complaints. You mentioned that the TCPA is a popular statute, and that was one of the surprising things to me in the oral argument, is that some of the justices embedded that into their question, this conceit that it's a popular statute. But that seems to all be a matter of perspective and whether one thinks the statute is effective in what it's intended to do, which is to prevent illegal robocalls as opposed to legal robocalls. You gave some remarks last year, maybe a year ago, where you said, repeat after me, robocall is not a bad word. And you talked about this distinction between, you know, good and bad robocalls, and that it's just a technology. And you received a lot of blowback for that. Can you talk about your perspective on that issue and why it seems at times the distinction is lost in the overall robocall debate?
Well, I think that the volume of illegal robocalls to consumers, you know, dwarfs the small number of legitimate callers and the benefits that they bring. And so people can, you know, don't like to be disrupted by illegal robocalls. No one seems to, but we tend to, you know, use just robocalls in general rather than being more clear on the issue. And it really does matter for our purposes, because one's a statutory issue and the other, you know, to your point in terms of the popularity issue, you know, there are a number of statutes the court deals with that are popular. And I remember dealing with some healthcare ones that were unpopular, and it didn't matter for their purposes of deciding, what the favorables were on any particular statute. Because if it did, you know, you would have the First Amendment be junked long ago. And so the First Amendment, the beauty of it, and one of the beauties of it, at least in my opinion, is that it protects, the speech, even if unpopular. And that's where we are in some of these instances. And you talked about, or your question certainly gets to the issue of, you know, good and bad robocalls. And I've been very protective of good robocalls because there's so many that benefit society, and the cost of making them is the differentiation for those that need to, between making a call and not making a call. So you want that call from your pharmacy to tell you that your prescription's up. You want that call from your school to say that school's being closed early, come get your children. You want that call from the gas company to tell you, hey, there's been an issue in your neighborhood. We need to get people out of Dodge. Or the opposite, that the issue's been resolved and you can return to your home safely. You want those calls. There are upteen number of instances that we've dealt with in the past, a number of items that we've already adopted for this purpose, and we have so many petitions before us that would deal with a number of good robocalls, beneficial robocalls that are being challenged, or certainly being the murkiness of the statute and the FCC's actions have made it more difficult and put precarious those who want to make the calls in a very precarious situation. So we want to get to the bad robocalls, and we want to keep the good robocalls. And on how the actions of the commission have flowed over the last many years has certainly been telling. We spent too much time, in my opinion, going after legitimate calls, and not enough time in the former category going after those that are trying to perpetrate these illegal robocalls, many of them overseas. And just recently, we've done a better job of fixing that direction.
Well, those comments go to, you know, where the FCC's focus should be in taking things up a level from this particular case. When robocalls are talked and written about, it seems to be either from the perspective of consumer complaints or the large number of them, or class action abuse and serial plaintiffs. Can you talk about, you know, your perspective on that balancing as a regulator and where your priorities lie?
Well, look, if we were to separate the First Amendment conversation for the immediate purposes of answering your question, it still is a premier for my analysis. But if I separate it for our purposes now, you know, the purpose of the call and what it can be used for to benefit consumers has to be acknowledged. And then we do get quite a number of complaints, people being disrupted, people being, you know, bothered at certain times, or repetitive calls from the same entity. That is, you know, that is certainly a priority of the enforcement side of the equation. How do you deal with it? And it's being, in my opinion, you know, how do I approach it as a regulator? I would answer the question: you have to do it very smartly, and that means not spending all our time on the legitimate side, but really attack those the bulk of calls that are happening that are very clearly illegal. I like the work we've done just recently with the FTC to try and get at those that are trying to use U.S. as providers that are carrying their traffic through. Some of the technology that we've adopted and will be a part of the TRACE Act, a recent statute enacted by the Congress and now law, certainly will help, in some degree, labeling and identification will certainly help the consumer know what's beneficial. But from my perspective, I have to take this from a recognition that there are protections, certainly the First Amendment pieces, but also the legitimate company trying to provide a benefit should not be stymied by a legal system and a structure in a statute that has endorsed bounty litigators. And that's not beneficial for the American consumer as a whole, and it's certainly not beneficial for the FCC.
Well, thank you, because I think that is part of the debate that often gets neglected. The FCC has really focused on stopping illegal robocalls, but recently the FCC on its own motion liberalized the TCPA rules to facilitate certain emergency communications related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you talk about what the agency did and why?
Well, again, there's a recognition early on that there's a number of steps the commission has taken, and the chairman has certainly pushed us forward during the recent pandemic on addressing immediate needs, and the commission has taken action here to provide clarity of getting the emergency communications through. I think there's more work to be done. I've been very supportive of a petition put forward by the financial services industry, which, at large, I mean, no number of organizations that aren't the best of friends came together and said, look, we're trying to provide communications to consumers to fit a couple of different categories to benefit during the pandemic. And that's been pending, and hopefully we'll be able to take action on that soon. So there's some action that we've already done to clarify, provide, a little bit of relief so providers can contact those as it relates to the pandemic and the issues of COVID-19. There's much more work to be done to provide more clarity. I think of the thought, the issues that I worked hard on in over the years as it relates to housing and financial security, and the belief that a lender shouldn't be capable of contacting a homeowner that their mortgage may need a modification, or there are beneficial programs that may help them keep in their home, and we put that on the sideline. And say, we're going to have to, if you have exposure points from potential liability under TCPA. And so we know the answer is going to be, because we've seen it time and time again, they won't make the calls. And then consumers will get a notice in the mail that says, your loan, you're now in default. Here's what the procedures that we're going to start to move forward on. And that to me is really problematic. I have deep concern for those consumers who are not notified, who are not the calls that do not go through and are not made because of the situation we find ourselves in on TCPA.
One of the things we hear whenever the TCPA is going to be liberalized, or where there are consent exceptions for meritorious calls like the ones you're talking about, is that it's going to be abused, or that the volume of calls will be so large that it's not warranted, no matter how good the cause. Have you had any feedback, positive or negative, about the flexibility that's been offered for COVID-19 calling? Who's using the additional flexibility, and how do you think that it's working?
To be honest, I think the numbers are so, the number of illegal robocalls are so high in the billions that adding, 100,000 new calls or under our new structure, the new flexibility provided. And I'm giving a rough estimate that to me has had little impact. And I haven't received one complaint that I've seen from the new flexibility issues. And that's why I'm comfortable, because I know the people the people and the companies that underlie those that have sought more flexibility, and they're not interested in risking their reputation on making the bothersome calls that consumers don't like. They're trying to provide benefits, and that's why I pointed out the financial services. But there's many other companies that are in the same straits, and I'd like to see us treat them all similar and broaden out the application at petition when we get to that point. And so I have not had a high risk, incident rate from the flexibility we had, and should be telling to the rest of the commission that this isn't a problematic situation we're going under, given all of the other robocalls that are made illegally and should be addressed otherwise.
Agreed. Well, no discussion of the TCPA would be complete without mentioning the elephant in the room, which is the definition of the automatic telephone dialing system, or ATDS. Sure. This gets pretty wonky pretty fast, but ATDS is the definition is the trigger for the consent requirements. If you're using an ATDS, you need consumer consent. And the FCC under a prior chairman defined the term ATDS very expansively to cover even equipment that could be modified to do auto dialing. The D.C. Circuit said that was too far, vacated the order, and remanded the issue to the commission, where it remains pending. Meanwhile, the federal circuit courts have split on how the term should be defined. The Ninth Circuit has the broadest definition that includes any equipment that can store lists of numbers, while the Third, Seventh, and Eleventh Circuits have a narrower reading requiring use of a random or sequential number generator for equipment to be an ATDS. How do you think that this language should be interpreted? And I should add, I feel that this is a fair question only because in vacating the FCC's expansive definition, the D.C. Circuit seemed to favor an interpretation that you offered in a dissent.
Well, I certainly appreciate that the court had read my points that I raised at the time. I believe a statute, as someone who worked on statutes for many years of his career, to be the words that are on the paper. And I certainly believe legislative history is beneficial. But I believe in this instance that the circuits are only split because you have the Ninth Circuit, which is ignoring the statute. The others are in different degrees, abiding by the law. People can disagree whether the law is good or bad and can have policy disagreements with it and whether it should be changed. But the conditions that the other circuits have placed outside of the Ninth Circuit are in the statute, in my opinion. And if people don't like that there is a remedy to that, and that is to go to your elected representatives and have them change the statute. It's not to have a court read into it what it would like statute to be. And that's what I think the problem is of the Ninth Circuit, and I think that's why I think it's important for the commission to act, given the course of action by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, sending the ACA mass back into our laps and back into the FCC's laps to take action, provide that definition, which to my mind is to follow the statute. Now, there are other issues that go into that. There are other issues that we need to address as well, and the commission is working on some of those. But that is the biggest one, the more thorny. And if at the end of the day, if our rules and our interpretation, which follows the law, is not approved yet by people, don't feel comfortable with it, then they have the remedy, and that's the one they should pursue rather than asking us to act outside the bounds of our authority.
So that's tantalizing to some of us to hear that the FCC is thinking about what to do next with the D.C. Circuit's remand. Are we likely to see FCC action in this proceeding anytime soon?
Well, I got to tell you, I got to leave all those issues on timing up to the chairman. I've certainly called for that because I think in the meantime, what you're seeing is that companies are being challenged and dragged into the Ninth Circuit. And so if you can find a way to find some type of activist to take the case to the Ninth Circuit, you can get a favorable ruling versus some of the other circuits that you may not be favorable. And I think that's, the forum shopping is incredibly problematic. I'm hopeful that maybe the action and the decision in the Barr case will provide energy to the commission, but I just don't know. It's been out there for quite a while. And if we're not going to, I've made the point that if we are not going to act on the definition and the big ticket items that need to be addressed, if we're going to set them aside for whatever reason, then we have to act on the petitions that are pending. And the list keeps growing. Majority of them by far are legitimate companies seeking clarity to provide beneficial calls to consumers that would not only benefit, but have actually sought out the calls themselves. And so for my purposes, we've got to, we should be shrinking that universe of petition list down and addressing as much clarity as we possibly can.
Well, we've covered a lot of territory at this point in the discussion, and maybe this is an opportunity to open things up and hear if we have any questions from our audience.
Perfect. Let's go to audience questions. We'll now go to the first caller.
This is John Meyer, and I believe that in addition to all the illegal calls, I think there are many more legal ones than you're saying, and I think 99% of them are still calls that people don't want. In fact, I believe that most of these people are committing a nuisance, but they're just not possible to sue. I think a narrowest legal interpretation of allowable robocalls should be used, and I just think that the idea that they're beneficial on balance to consumers is wrong. And what I really think should happen is you ought to have to be licensed in order to do robocalls. But that isn't really a question. So my question would be, how much is the FTC, or is FCC or FTC, whichever you are, considering the harassment to consumers, even from legal robocalls?
Well, I certainly appreciate your perspective. That's not the statute that governs our activities in this case. The TCPA has certain limitations, and it doesn't get to the points you make. That is certainly something Congress could try to craft. I think it would run into some First Amendment problems if it did so. I understand that people don't want any calls, and there is technology out there that would help. There are tons of blocking programs that prevent, whether they be identified calls, or they go down the different options that you can choose. Those just aren't in the current statute in terms of the issues that we're raising here today. And so it's a high priority at the FCC. The chairman has labeled it the number one consumer protection issue. And I think that we can spend a great deal of time debating whether legal robocalls are beneficial. But the real issue is how do you shrink the illegal robocalls? I don't think I said 99%. I said there's a good bulk of them coming from overseas that need to be addressed. That's a real thorny issue, especially as you're going to drive those calls to places where we don't have extradition, where they don't have, normalized treaties with the United States. And so that's really hard and really thorny work because the technology makes calling so cheap. It can be done just about anywhere on the planet. And so I appreciate your perspective. It's not the one that governs our activities, and Congress certainly could go down that path. It has chosen not to, and I suspect it probably won't in the near term anyway.
Commissioner, and I would just add to your comments that the question posits a legal solution, but there are many efforts being made on technical solutions, including at the Commission with some of its efforts on the TRACE Act implementation. But there are also many user empowerment tools out in the market, apps that are free that can be used for blocking that are widely available, and they're rated on which ones are the most effective. They're available from all sorts of third parties, but also from the carriers. So there are ways to get at it short of licensing.
Oh no, absolutely. And the stir shaken work that we've done and now been basically codified by the TRACE Act will provide more clarity when those calls come into consumers and their desire to pick them up and provides more notification on that front. It's not a panacea, but it can be very beneficial. And you highlight a number of technological solutions that are out there. One of the things the commission did, which I think is reasonable, is make and certainly supported and made clear that some of the blocking technologies that were available in the marketplace could be deployed by providers for purposes of helping consumers, but they weren't prohibited from doing so. The issue came of who's going to pay, who's not going to pay, and there's a little different distance agreement on those situations. But I think that's beneficial, to have, and you see this by providers are taking advantage of doing this. Now, the flip side of that is I want to make sure that those calls that they block are really going after the illegal robocalls, because the beneficial calls shouldn't be blocked by our providers. And having a relationship between legitimate companies willing to use this technology and the provider, we've got to figure out that situation. Something that TRACE Act has pushed us to do, and I'm looking forward to figuring out how do we have a process to make sure that good calls get through.
Do we have another question?
The next one. Perfect. Yeah, let's go to the next question.
Hey, this is Howard Busker. Commissioner, thanks for doing this. So I just wanted to, I know that you don't set the agenda at the FCC, but it sort of feels as though, I think when this administration started, there was a sense that based on sort of your reaction and Chairman Pai's reaction to the declaratory order that had been approved under former Chairman Wheeler, that there would be some changes. But it seems like most of the focus has just been on, further. People hate robocalls so much that there's just been so much emphasis on that, but very relatively little done to sort of clear the way for other more legitimate callers. Is there anything happening or any conversations you're having within the FCC that give you a sense that something more could happen by the end of this year?
Well, look, I appreciate your question, Howard. I think the point I would respond and say the chairman's done yeoman work to try and get at the illegal robocall issue. Some of it I thought was better than others. Some of it's going to be more helpful than others. And I think they're really honing into what might be incredibly valuable going forward. And so, that may have been the priorities. How do we get some benefits and programs that really can help consumers up front before we address some of the other issues? So the priorities is up to the chairman. I don't know if I'm optimistic in the near term that we're going to get any resolution. I'd like to believe so. That's, I'm an optimist. I think it's absolutely necessary, certainly with the split in the circuits. And I should say that I haven't been no fan of the Second Circuit and where they've gone in terms of the definitional interpretations either. But I think that there's more work that we could do. The agency itself is got some issues, as you can imagine, given the closure of most of activity in Washington, D.C. The good staff is working really hard. Most of everyone is from home. And so I really appreciate what they've been able to do. I'd like to believe we can provide more clarity this year, and we'll just have to see if that can happen.
Thank you.
Let's go to the next caller.
Okay, it's Tricia Pauletta. Okay, so hey, Tricia Pauletta from Wilter and Grannis. Thank you, Commissioner O'Reilly, for joining us. I have a bit of a curveball. If it's too obtuse, you can politely, give me a non-answer. But I heard you mentioned the TRACE Act and implementation, and I had heard from another policymaker and another part of the government that between the TRACE Act implementation and rip and replace and the secure 5G bill, which granted money for removing Chinese equipment from from networks that the smaller carriers out there that still had Chinese equipment in their network could take advantage of that money being out there to kind of do a twofer and put in trusted vendor equipment while also upgrading their networks to, have in-network blocking, to implement the an identification to implement the TRACE Act. But any thinking within the FCC on that, or do you see that connection? It had been new to me. I had to go back and read the various bills to see that there was even kind of a connection.
Well, your point's well taken. I do worry that there isn't, there's been a question of how far the dollars would go and the rip and replace side of the equation and then how long it would take. A number of providers, when we were doing personal meetings before this current circumstances, highlighted how expensive it would be and how time consuming it would be to replace the equipment that the Congress had decided. And so I think there's, I could certainly see a scenario where you could do both, where you could use the timing in the one, but I wonder if people aren't going to be, or providers aren't going to be subsumed in making sure that they do a fulsome job on the first without trying to shoehorn some of the other functionality that can be beneficial. We'll just have to see. I haven't heard any providers suggest that would be the case, but we'll just have to see.
Thank you.
Commissioner, a related question to Tricia's while we're waiting for the next audience question. Separate and apart from the availability of rip and replace or other money, certainly you're sensitive to the fact that TRACE Act implementation is more of a challenge for small and rural carriers than it may be for the larger ones. Can you discuss your thinking about that and how the FCC will face the unique challenges they have in implementing this particular mandate?
Well, yes, we're mindful of the impact in some instances statutorily set, but we're always mindful of the impact of obligations that are imposed. The TRACE Act, I think, does a fairly good job in a number of instances separating that out and recognizing what they see as more, where they provide more flexibility for smaller providers. But that is part of the role of a regulator to be and to recognize where provided some flexibility to where the circumstances it may be needed. Smaller providers have maybe the same cost as a larger provider, but have less flexibility in terms of the timing. In some instances, it may be weather driven. In terms of rip and replace, it's not something you're going to be able to do 12 months a year. It's certainly out in, above the Mason-Dixon line. I think of, you know, what you can do in Buffalo in the winter for my home, you know, hometown, and you're not climbing towers, you're not replacing radios in January. So I'm mindful of those things, and where we can and where we do have flexibility, I want to take advantage of it to make sure everything can work. In other instances, the statute is what the statute says, and then I have to abide by it, and I trust that those that are aggrieved will have an opportunity to raise their issues either in Congress or, you know, we can look at whether we might have some waiver authority.
Great.
Perfect. Well, let's go to the next question.
Hi. I have a question for the commissioner. My name is Michael. I'm in Maryland. And the question is about vicarious liability. The FCC has given an opinion about that in a couple of its orders, and courts defer to that opinion, as they generally do to the FCC's orders. But vicarious liability seems like something that's not really in the FCC's area of expertise. And there was a dissenting opinion by one of the commissioners, I believe, saying what I just said. So my question is, since the Supreme Court has indicated, not in the TCPA, but for another area of law, that federal obligations can't be contracted out, which is typically what happens with telemarketing calls, why isn't the FCC sort of following what the Supreme Court has said, so that we don't have the situation where sellers of products or services find a fly-by-night, far-flung telemarketer to make calls that both the FCC and FTC have trouble tracking down, and certainly, you know, individuals do, and then let the seller off using or citing the FCC's opinion, because it seems like a big impediment to, you know, enforcing the statute and getting robocalls stopped.
Yeah, I appreciate your question. I think that, you know, we would acknowledge that vicarious liability is not an absolute expertise of the FCC compared to other agencies. And you could see this in other instances. I would say that if you look at the call volume and the number of complaints that we receive compared to we've declared it our number one priority, it pales in comparison to the number that the FTC gets in every year. And they have so many more that the complaints that they're getting, and they've approached it differently than we have. We're just recently, we've done some more joint enforcement actions with them, and I think that's more mindful than unleashing the litigants that we've seen over the last many years, and the structure of the statute, where we make it a bounty plaintiff lawyer opportunity, and then that's, you know, we've got six or seven law firms that are specializing in this, to capture and to try to scare legitimate companies from using this technology, and in some regards, it's worked. The number of providers. A number of legitimate commerce companies that we know today do not take advantage of this technology, even though it would be beneficial to the consumers, to their customers, because of the risks of the liability. You see that in the petitions that are before us. And that shouldn't be the circumstance. And I don't know how much I would agree with your point that the legitimate companies are hiring fly-by-night artists and throwing calls for that purpose. When I, you know, the folks that I'm articulating and are defending for making legitimate calls hire legitimate companies for this purpose. And it's not too dissimilar to go back all the way, circle back to the court case that's before the Supreme Court. Why did Congress try to exempt the debt that's owed to the United States? Because it wants the opportunity to collect the money that it is owed, whether it be in student loans or whatever. And I've had difficulty with some of the interpretations of that statute, because they've tried to narrow it to say that it only could be done with in-house of the agency. But we all know that the agencies themselves, you know, setting up their own telemarketing campaigns are not going to be as efficient as hiring a top tier telemarketing firm that is completely legitimate for these purposes. So I'm really concerned that, that people have the view that legitimate companies would do deceptive practices for these, you know, then go through these and you know, have a brand and put it at risk by hiring, you know, whomever on the cheap to make these calls. That to me is not what the record shows, and not before is not been, it's been articulated by some folks I've seen and heard from, but I find that, you know, hard to believe and not demonstrated in the record at all.
Let's go to our next caller. Caller from area code 801, you're on the line.
Yeah, I have a question concerning the interaction that the Supreme Court had in defining privacy as one of the issues that supported positions. They seem to suggest that, or at least the government's position seemed to suggest that privacy was or wasn't part of this issue. And with the new rules coming out, both at state and federal levels regarding privacy, do you see that issue of the combining of privacy with these other regulatory issues as being a big influence on the direction you're going? And if so, how do you think that's going to influence your decisions?
Well, the issue of privacy, and it's a very complex one because it depends on, there's many different elements that go into that. I did, the oral arguments did provide, you know, a number of members touched upon it, but I didn't find it as a central theme, and they didn't strike it as the traditional privacy structure that we talk about, and that has been the subject of much debate in Congress in terms of a new statute they may want to consider, or activity that's happened overseas and is now governing a lot of information sharing practices that are happening. So I find the issue of privacy to be really stimulating for the intellect, but actually providing benefit to consumers, I find it missing a lot of help, and that's I hope that comes through in my conversations today. And my point early on is that I don't like and do not support and will never support illegal robocalls, and that is the bulk of what, you know, we should be tackling certainly in our efforts, and hasn't been in the past. And I appreciate all the good work that Chairman Pai has done to refocus the agency on those issues through a number of different means. Some may support what he's done in terms of timing or not, but that's for him to decide. But I really appreciate getting to where we're finally getting to. You know, that's important. So I don't know if I would bleed this into a larger privacy discussion. I think it's a statute on its face. It certainly could, you know, be something that the Congress could reconsider depending on what happens in the court case in this instance or in potential other ones.
I would just add to that. It's a good question. And privacy in this context is a little different than what we think of under something like, you know, GDPR or the California privacy law, where the interest that's being protected is the consumer right not to have something revealed about him or her that is otherwise kept private. And that sort of an interest isn't really impinged by the TCPA. The privacy interest that's articulated is the right not to be disturbed or annoyed, but it is different. And the Council for the Political Consultants made that point in arguing to the Supreme Court. Their point was, if this is a core privacy statute and the interest that's being validated by the government is preventing people from being disturbed, how can they adopt an exemption that would allow for people to be disturbed as long as the purpose is to collect a government debt? That was inconsistent. So I do think there's some tension about the TCPA being a true privacy statute.
I certainly believe that, you know, it is mentioned in the statute and mentioned in the legislative history when enacted in 91. So it's definitely a purpose. But your point is the one I was making. You made it more eloquently. I think it's a slightly different variation of privacy, and we'll just have to see again, where the cart goes. One thing we talked about early on and kind of moved to a different direction, but I'm really intrigued about the remedy side. Because you certainly saw a lot of folks talk about the severability issue, a handful of justices talk about the severability issue. And one thing that I hadn't heard before or read in other cases is the idea that if plaintiffs were successful, that they were somewhat owed some type of relief. And then what relief would be if the exemption were struck down, what would be their relief? And I thought that was very intriguing approach. And what that would mean for the statute. And look at, I answered the issue earlier of what would happen if TCPA were to be struck. And I didn't mean to be flippant in the point that I don't know that it would change all that much. It certainly have an impact. But I think my answer is driven on to the point that I think it would, and I think this is raised in oral arguments, is that it would drive Congress to enact a much more thoughtful, technical statute that wasn't exactly of mindset in 1991 in terms of where we are and what our wireless communications look today compared to 1991, vastly different. And I think that everyone could benefit from more clarity.
To keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls, you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Telefora on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed, as well as on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. Commissioner and Scott, is there anything you want to say before we conclude?
I just want to thank Commissioner O'Reilly for joining us. Commissioner, you're always insightful on these topics, and we very much appreciate your willingness to be forthcoming. Really appreciate your joining us and taking the time.
Well, thank you all. And thank the Federalist Society for having me and having this forum. I realize it's a really particular subject matter, and not everyone is attuned to every component, and God bless them. They don't need to. That's somewhat with the job at the FCC and the FTC. So I really appreciate the opportunity to dig into some of these issues. And I think as a whole, we're all anxious to see what happens in the court case. And see if the commission has the will to act on its own accord as we go forward. So I thank the audience of those that listened, and I look forward to continuing to advocate in the subject matter.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.